Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Good afternoon, everyone. Okay. Today we will continue with the study of the Sutta Nipata. And today we will take a sutta called the Parabhava Sutta. This comes in our book, in the translation. It begins on page 11. It's sutta number 6 in the Sutta Nipata. And the sutta takes the form of a dialogue between the Buddha and a deva. A deva is a deity. And last time I spoke, I gave a little explanation of the Buddha's daily routine. And each day, in the middle of the night, the Buddha would reserve part of the night for answering questions from the deities. So while the rest of the monastery where he was staying would be quiet, all the other monks, most of them would be asleep, though a few would still be sitting in meditation. But when everything is quiet, dark, then deities would come from the different heavenly worlds to ask questions of the Buddha. This might seem surprising to people coming from a Christian or theistic background, that God should be asking questions from a human being, since human beings should be considered as inferior to the gods. But in the Buddha's teaching, in Buddhism, the Buddha is regarded as Satta Deva Manusanam. That means he is the teacher of gods and human beings. And by reason of his supreme enlightenment, he is superior even to the highest deities. So even the deities from, whether it be the lower heavenly worlds, the higher heavenly worlds, deities who are ruling over supreme heavenly worlds, deities who are the lords of huge world systems, come to the Buddha, bow down to him, and ask him questions to resolve their doubts. And so this sutta that we're going to study takes the form of a dialogue between a deity and the Buddha about the causes or conditions for downfall, that is, moral and spiritual downfall. And now, before we look at the contents of the sutta itself, I want to try to place the sutta within, you might call it, a systematic framework of the Buddha's teaching. And many people think that Buddhism, especially early Buddhism, is concerned solely with renunciation, taking on the life of a monastic person, meditating in solitude, and gaining enlightenment and liberation. And so they think that early Buddhism is concerned solely with otherworldly goals, and that it doesn't have anything to offer people living within the world. But if we take a look at the Buddha's discourses, we see that the Buddha gave so many discourses concerned with the proper way to live life within the world. The Buddha, it's said that the Buddha arises in the world for the welfare and happiness of many people, out of compassion for the world, and in doing so, he teaches people the causes and conditions that lead to their well-being and happiness within the world. And so we have, within the early Buddhist teachings, I call them two strata, two dimensions of the Buddha's teaching. One is the world-transcending teaching, the Lokuttara Dhamma, the teaching that leads to final, ultimate liberation, to Nibbana. And then what we might call the mundane, world-enhancing, life-enhancing teaching, which is concerned with improving our moral and spiritual life, and even our economic and social life within the world. The mundane, world-promoting teaching, again, has, I would call it, two dimensions, two aspects. So we divide the mundane, world-promoting teaching into two sections. One consists of those teachings which are designed to show the conditions leading to a favorable rebirth. That it's still concerned with life within the world, but now we are concerned with gaining a happy, favorable, or fortunate rebirth in our next life and in lives after that. The other aspect of this world-promoting teaching is concerned with promoting the happiness and well-being of people in this life itself. Then the teachings concerned with promoting the happiness and well-being of people in this life also have two aspects. That is, we can divide them into two further strata, two further categories, which are usually closely interrelated. One is those teachings concerned with avoiding what is evil, avoiding what is unwholesome. The second is concerned with performing what is good, doing what is wholesome. Okay, so now having developed this schema of the Buddha's teachings, the Parabhava Sutta, the discourse on downfall, belongs within the mundane world-promoting teaching concerned with happiness in this life and concerned with achieving happiness by avoiding evil, avoiding unwholesome actions, avoiding the causes, the conditions for misery. So we can say that this sutta is concerned with the simplest, most elementary stage of the Buddha's teaching. And I know people who come to Buddhism, sometimes they like to study Abhidhamma, to investigate how the mind could be analyzed into so many different states of mind, mental factors, different conditional relations. Very interesting. Some people like to study Madhyamaka to see all of these absolutely compelling proofs, demonstrations that nothing arises, nothing ceases, nothing exists, nothing does not exist. Some people like Yogacara, these proofs, demonstrations that the world is just a projection of seeds within the mind. All very interesting. Compared to that, this teaching about avoiding the causes of downfall will seem very elementary, very boring perhaps, very simplistic, but also it's very important. And if you want to recognize the importance of it, just flip on the news channel on any television, the computer, and then you'll see the importance of avoiding the causes of evil. But now I have to introduce another distinction, and that is evil deeds, unwholesome deeds, can be of two kinds, that is, gross and subtle. Okay, so evil deeds can be of two kinds. There are gross evil deeds, which are, you call them just open violations of the five precepts, killing, stealing, and so on. Then there are subtle evil deeds. The subtle evil deeds I would call attitudes and types of conduct that at first sight might not be terribly wrong, terribly evil, but if we consider them carefully, examine them closely, we would find that they become the breeding ground of harm and suffering later on. These are definitely causes of downfall. And the sutta that we're going to examine is concerned primarily with these, though it also takes some account of what we can call the gross types of evil. Okay, so we begin on one occasion. It is the middle of the night when everyone else is asleep and the Buddha is awake at Savatthi in the Jeta Grove. This is Anathapindika's monastery. And then on this beautiful night, a certain devata, a deity, descends from the heavenly world down to the earth. That when the deva comes, his body gives rays of light. Those rays of light illuminate the entire Jeta's grove. The deity comes to the Buddha, bows down to him, then stands to one side and poses his question, makes his request. Then I like to recite in Pali. Parabhavantam purisang mayang puchama gotamang Bhagavantam putang agama king parabhavato mukang. So he says, I wish to ask you, Gotama, he addresses the Buddha by his clan name, about a person who suffers downfall. I have approached you in order to inquire about the causes of downfall. Then the Buddha replies, again I use Pali, Suvi jano bhavang hoti, suvi jano parabhavo, dhamma kamo bhavang hoti, dhamma desi parabhavo. Okay, translated, the progressive one, the successful one, is easy to know, and the one who declines, the one who undergoes downfall, is also easy to know. Then he gives now the first cause of, on the one hand, progress, on the other hand, downfall. He says, the one who loves the Dhamma is successful, progressive, and the one who hates the Dhamma undergoes downfall. The verse itself is very vague about exactly what is meant by loving Dhamma, hating Dhamma. The commentary, the way commentaries do, come in and they give very specific explanation. They say that what is meant by Dhamma here are the 10 causes of wholesome action. That is, the 3 causes of bodily action, abstaining from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, the 3 causes of verbal wholesome action, abstaining from lying, malicious speech, harsh speech, and idle chatter, and the 3 courses of mental wholesome action, avoiding covetousness, having a mind of goodwill, and holding right view. But I think sometimes commentators, by giving very specific explanations, tie a text down to too narrow an interpretation. So I like to leave the word Dhamma open in its significance, not tie it to a specific conceptual category. And so I think we could take Dhamma here in the broadest sense in which it was understood in the India of that period. Here, Dhamma doesn't have to mean only the Buddha's teaching, but Dhamma, the word Dhamma was used before the Buddha appeared on the scene. The word Dhamma was used by the Buddha's contemporaries. And even in India today, whether Buddhist or non-Buddhist, the word Dhamma will be easily understood by people that come from a religious background. So the word Dhamma has the sense of, you could call it, the principle of virtue, the principle of goodness, the principle of truth, the principle of rightness. All of these ideas are bound together, tied together in this word Dhamma. And so what the Buddha discovers is the Dhamma in its fullness, in its deepest dimension, in its broadest implications. And then the Buddha comes upon the Indian scene as Dhammaraja, the king of the Dhamma, Dhammasami, the lord or master of the Dhamma, even as one who is Dhammabhuto, the one who has become the Dhamma, or Dhammakayo, the embodiment of Dhamma. And so we can see this verse is indicating that one who develops this love of virtue, love of goodness, love of right, love of justice, love of truth, and experiences, makes a deep commitment to goodness, justice, rightness, virtue, and truth, is the person who will succeed in life. Whereas the person who hates these qualities, the person who is against justice, against truth, against rightness, against virtue, is the one who will decline and deteriorate. But even though the verse speaks about hating Dhamma, I want to make an addition to that verse. What's particularly dangerous is not only hating Dhamma, but becoming indifferent to Dhamma, in the sense that one thinks that the spiritual values that are all tied together in this word Dhamma don't have any kind of substantial validity, that they don't have any kind of binding truth to them, that one thinks that they are perhaps just figments of the human imagination. And so when one just gets swept away by current popular materialistic ideas or materialistic values, and so one just turns one's back upon all of these ideas of truth, goodness, virtue, rightness, and just pursues a rather blind, unthinking, egotistical, self-centered way of life, that is also a way of life that leads to downfall. But for those of us who have met the Buddha's Dhamma, then it becomes especially important to develop a very, very deep and genuine love for the Dhamma. The text uses the word kama here, which usually it's used in a negative sense in the text. Usually kama means sensual desire, sensual craving. But here the word kama is used in relation to the Dhamma. So it's emphasizing that one should develop this love for these spiritual values and especially for the Buddha's teaching. And this becomes the connection that binds one to the Buddha's teaching and makes one treasure the Buddha's teaching, so that one doesn't become indifferent to it, doesn't lose one's interest in the Buddha's teaching, and doesn't let one's mind become swept away by any type of competing spiritual teaching. Okay, so this is the first answer that the Buddha gives to the question of the deity. Now, in the translation, the translator has left out, you could see from the numbering, the continued questions of the deity, because the deity will, after the Buddha gives each answer, the deity will say simply that now he accepts this answer of the Buddha, and he asks a second question about another cause of downfall. So in this case, the deity will say, Iti hetang vijanama patamo so parabhavo tutiyang bhagava bruhi kangpara bhavato mukang. He says, we understand this first cause of downfall. And now, O Blessed One, I ask a second question. What is a cause of downfall? And then the Buddha replies, Asantasa piyahunti sante na kurute piyang asatang dhammang rocheti tangpara bhavato mukhang. Okay, following the translation given, one who loves the company of the vicious, the evil ones, the bad people, finds no delight with the virtuous. Actually, I don't quite agree with that translation. I would translate it, okay, to him the vicious people or the bad people are dear, and he doesn't form affection towards the virtuous. He professes or comes to prefer the doctrine of the vicious. This is a cause of one's downfall. Okay, this verse points to the need to avoid the wrong type of friends and associate with the right type of friends. And this, again, this is a principle that's emphasized again and again in different ways by the Buddha throughout his teaching. The Buddha again and again speaks about the need to avoid what are called papamita, that's bad friends, and to associate with kalyanamita, good friends, virtuous friends. That is because when we are in our early stages of spiritual development, we are very easily influenced by the people we associate with. When we reach higher stages of spiritual development, then we can go back and associate with what we call bad people and try to transform them, change them, and lead them onto the right path. But when we are in our early stages, and we should always be humble and think, like the Dalai Lama says, I'm still just a relative beginner. Always think that we are in the early stages. We have to be very careful of the people that we associate with, because even without our knowing it, we get influenced by the people that we associate with. Their attitudes, their way of speaking, almost imperceptibly pass over to us. And so if we associate with people, say, who have violent attitudes, who speak roughly, who have worldly interests, just concerned with getting wealthy, or just talk about sports, entertainment, politics, then our own minds will get turned into that direction. And so, of course, when we come across these people in our day-to-day life, we have to be cordial to them, congenial, friendly to them. If we can help them, we should try to do so. But we should especially try to keep some distance from those people, especially people who have charismatic personalities, but also bad character traits. Because if we come into their sphere of influence, sometimes their charismatic personality will start to affect us, will attract us, so that we get drawn to their personalities, and then their bad characters, their bad qualities will start to act upon us and change us in bad ways. And then the Buddha gives, in this verse, he points out one very important aspect about this wrong association. And that is, when one comes to associate with the bad people, then one comes to adopt their Dhamma. One comes to adopt their doctrine or their teaching. And especially in this time, this period of time, when there are so many materialistic teachings floating around, so many people have a materialist outlook, and if you're trying to lead a spiritual life, follow the Buddha's path, then you associate with people who have a materialistic, worldly attitude. They learn that you are trying to follow Buddhism, then maybe they will ridicule you. They'll ask you, what is the value of this? They'll tell you, look, we are quite happy, we are living successfully, we're not following Buddhism, And look at you. You used to be quite a happy, happy-go-lucky person. And now you've stopped going to the monastery and you're walking around with a grim look on your face. Be like us. We go out nightclubs, we go out singing, dancing, we're all laughing, partying, and you just come always looking in the book, so serious, so grim. And then you might start getting worried and think, am I really changing in that way? Am I really starting to become so grim, so serious? Maybe I should give up this Buddhism. I'm not really benefiting from it. Okay, so this verse emphasizes the need to avoid wrong association and then to form right association, to associate with the good people. But here, since it's talking about the causes of downfall, the emphasis is on avoiding bad association. Okay, now we come to the third point of advice. Now I'll just read the Buddha's replies. I won't read the question verses anymore. Nida sili sabha sili anutata chayo naro ala sokoda panyano tangpara bhavato mukhang. Okay, the meaning of the verse is being fond of sleep and being fond of company or association. Being lethargic, literally not rising, not being energetic. The person who is lazy and prone to anger, that is a cause of downfall. So here in this one verse, actually several causes of downfall are mentioned. Three of them have to do with laziness, being fond of sleep, oversleeping, just whenever one has spare time, sleeping long hours, not having energy to do any work. And whenever there's some work to be done, always finding excuses to put off that work. So this in itself, it doesn't seem to be something evil or morally wrong, but this laziness becomes like the breeding ground for unwholesome attitudes. It's within the lazy mind that greed, especially greed, hatred, anger, and particularly delusion, that they all have the chance to start to develop and to thrive. Then when the lazy person does feel a burst of energy, what does the person do? Instead of getting down and doing some serious work, they start looking for company, people to talk to. So that's why the verse speaks about being talkative. Literally, the expression means being fond of assemblies, meetings, company. Then when the person, after meeting with people, talking with people, when they are talking, because they don't have a developed mind, inevitably as the discussions go on, they'll get into disagreements with the people they're talking to. When they get into disagreements, then they become angry. So that leads to being irritable. Then when they get angry, they'll leave the assembly, go off. They don't know how to deal with the anger. They'll look around and think, what am I to do? Then they'll see the bed and think the quickest, most efficient way to get rid of the anger is to sleep it off. Then they take a nap, get up from the nap, again look for some more people to talk to, talk some more, get into arguments, get angry, then sleep again. And so the cycle goes on and on and on. So in this way, lethargy, talkativeness, and anger go around in a cycle. Okay, the next cause of downfall. Yo ma tarung fa pi tarung china kangata yo banang pahu santo nabarati tangpara bhavato mukhang. Okay, one who is himself sufficiently affluent but does not support his mother and father when they are old and infirm, this is a cause of one's downfall. Here the Buddha is speaking very much against the background of traditional agrarian Indian society, in which the family, the typical family, was an extended family. And in the extended family, each generation would take the responsibility for supporting the earlier generation. And the Buddha emphasized the importance of the children taking upon themselves the responsibility for the support of their parents when they become old and unable to look after themselves. He says that, this is in the Anguttara Nikaya, he says that there are two people that one can never repay, one's mother and one's father, because it's one's parents that give this very life to us. They give us our body and our life. When we are helpless infants, our parents look after us. They bring us up. They nourish us. They introduce us to the world. They take care of us till we are 20, 25 years old. And then even throughout our life, the parents are always concerned for our well-being. And so it therefore becomes our responsibility to look after our parents when they become old and unable to take care of themselves. It doesn't mean that in a larger family that each child should take on that responsibility, but amongst the children, at least one or two of the children in the family should take on the responsibility of looking after their parents. And what's happened in American society is that the traditional extended family has given way to the nuclear family, in which the family consists of just perhaps the parents, two children, and when the children grow up, they go their own way, and often the parents are left with nobody to look after them. And so parents in their old age are often very lonely. Or else, when they get old, they have to go to live in homes for the aged. And sometimes the children don't take care of the parents or come to see them very rarely. And so this emphasis upon the individual in American society, it all comes from this emphasis upon the importance of the individual, which is in a way, it was a very important value in the establishing of the American culture, American society. But then that emphasis upon individuality takes off on a tangent of its own and leads to the breakup of all sense of community. And so even the family, the very basis of biological life, gets split asunder to the point where parents are often just left alone by their children and rarely get to see them. They get their checks, their pensions, their social security checks. And then in their old age, they have to fend for themselves. But in the traditional society based upon traditional values, whether it's Buddhist values, Confucianist values, always there's this emphasis on the obligation of the younger generation to the older generation. And here in America, we always think the younger generation is always the wiser, smarter generation. The older generation becomes old-fashioned, out of it, no longer with it. But in a traditional society, there's the idea, prevalent idea, that the older generation is a wise generation, even though they might not be informed about the latest technology, the latest fashions, but people in their old age have gathered some wisdom through their experience of life that they can pass on to the younger generation. And so when one supports one's parents, one performs service of great merit, and one also has the opportunity to learn something from one's parents. Okay, the next cause of downfall. Yo brahmanang vasamanang va anyang va pivani. Yo brahmanang vasamanang va anyang va pivani bakang. Muzavadena vanjeti tang parabhavato mukhang. Okay, one who deceives by falsehood a priest, that's a brahmana, an ascetic or a monk. Now the translator says any other spiritual preceptor, but the text says any other mendicant. It doesn't say spiritual preceptor. One who deceives such a person by falsehood, that is a cause of one's downfall. And what is meant here by deceiving the priest or the ascetic is offering to provide support to the ascetic, offering to provide some gift to the ascetic, and then not following through with one's promise of support. That is the explanation given in the commentary. And there's a sutta, interesting sutta, that comes in the Anguttara Nikaya. The Venerable Sariputta comes to the Buddha and says, "What is the reason, Venerable Sir, that for some person here who undertakes business, his business does not succeed? For another person here who undertakes business, his business succeeds, but not as much as he expected. For another person here who undertakes business, his business succeeds exactly as he expected, while for another person here, his business succeeds more than he expected." Then the Buddha gives this answer. He says, there's somebody who in a previous life might have promise something to an ascetic or a Brahmin, promise perhaps to build a temple for him, promise to make some offering to him, promise to undertake some service to him, but then he doesn't follow through on that promise. For this person, when he later undertakes a business in this life, then his business does not succeed. Somebody else has made a promise to the Brahmin or the ascetic. He follows through on the promise, but not to the extent that he originally offered. If he promises to build, say, a temple for the Brahmin or the ascetic with, say, two stories, eventually he might build only a one-story temple for him. Or if he promises to support him with food, say, for a three-month period, he'll give him food for a one-month period, and then he might leave town without even giving notice that he'll be going out of town. And then the Brahmin or the ascetic has to manage on his own for the other 2 months. Okay, so when this person undertakes business, his business succeeds, but not to the extent that he expected. The third person is one who undertakes business, his business succeeds exactly as he expected. That is one who made the promise to the ascetic and then fulfilled it exactly as he promised. And the fourth person, the one whose business succeeds more than he expected, that is one who made the promise to the Brahmin or the ascetic and then fulfilled it even more than he originally promised. I have to say, the sutta seems a little bit suspicious to me. I could see at a period when monks are having some trouble getting offerings from lay people that they might want to just guarantee themselves a steady supply of the requisites, that they could slip a sutta like that into the canon very easily. In any case, to deceive with false speech a Brahmin or ascetic is definitely, it's a very serious, unwholesome action, because this is a person who is committed and devoted to leading a spiritual life, a life of renunciation dedicated to the quest for truth, the quest for purity, and then to deceive that person with some kind of bad intention is to create a rather heavy, unwholesome karma. Okay, now we come to the cause of downfall, the next cause of downfall. This is number 6, I think. This is verse number 12. Pahuta vito puriso sahiranyo sabojano eko bunjati saduni tangpara bhavato mukhang. Okay, the translation says, having ample wealth, assets and property, enjoying them alone, this is a cause of one's downfall. Okay, so this verse emphasizes the importance of giving or generosity. But the translator hasn't translated it literally. Translated literally, one who has abundant wealth, a lot of gold, a lot of food, who eats delicious things alone, that is a cause of one's downfall. So this places specific emphasis upon the giving of food, not simply giving in general, but on the sharing or giving of food. And again, this is a theme repeatedly emphasized in many Buddhist texts, the importance of sharing one's food, because food is the most basic requisite, the support of life. And in our own time, when there are so many hungry and starving people, and in other parts of the world, particularly in Africa, in Sudan, hundreds of thousands of people, in Niger over the past few weeks, hundreds of thousands of people on the verge of starvation, I think we should make a very determined effort to share our own wealth, even though we can't send food directly. But we should make donations to any kind of reliable agency concerned with providing aid and assistance for the people in these countries to save them from the brink of starvation. Okay, at this point, I will end the discourse for today, and then I will continue with the sutta next time. And I thank you all for listening and wish the blessings of the Triple Gem be with you all. Okay, if there are any questions, then we can take questions. For
Yes, Sanjay, I just wanted to comment that what's being taught here today is in my opinion, very important. And the thing that in my life is a challenge in this way mostly is I believe we have to practice metta, and I have learned to do that successfully, pretty much. And the only problem is that I find associating with people who, as you said, are not practicing Dhamma, I find it very hard because I feel like I do have some kind of involvement with them, and I can't just run away and join a monastery. In my case, you know, that would be just running away in my case, because I feel I have responsibilities elsewhere. But what's very difficult at times is the feeling, I do have the feeling of compassion within me for these people who do not recognize what the Dhamma teaches. And it can become very painful at times. So it's just, I kind of find that we have to accept that these things are in the world. You know, we have to accept that these things that aren't right, things that are wrong, bad, or evil, or whatever you might want to say. And even if it's not pleasurable, to practice Dhamma as best we can. And, you know, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Yeah, I think when the verse speaks about, let me just get the word. Yeah, it says, asantasa piya honti. Again, the translation says, one who loves the company of the bad. So it doesn't mean that in our day-to-day life that we have to avoid completely people who are not living the lives dedicated to the Dhamma. That's impossible, unless you're living in a monastery. Well, maybe even in the monastery. Excuse me?
I said not even as Thomas Merton found out in his spiritual practice, that going to a monastery to escape the world doesn't work either.
Yeah.
You know, because the world will come to you.
Yeah. But really the intention of the verse is that one should not associate with these people in a way in which one looks to them for guidance and puts oneself in a position of constantly seeking their company because one enjoys their company, and so one makes oneself sort of open to their negative influences upon one's character. That is what one has to avoid. Okay, any further questions? Okay, if there's no questions, then we will do the final sharing of the merit. Okay, we share the merit with the devas, the deities, the nagas, these are the dragon spirits, the bhutas, these are the sometimes harmful spirits, but by sharing merits, then we're able to win their affection and their protective influence. And we ask them to protect the Buddha's teaching, to protect the exposition of the teaching, to protect ourselves and others. And then we ask all beings to rejoice in the merits and to achieve all success. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang etavata chaham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata chaham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata chaham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sattha anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.